Okay, so I am more fired up than normal today. I have Christina Mendonza coming on the show today to share what she's doing. And if you haven't heard of Christina, then you aren't turning on the TV, the radio. You're probably not from Sacramento. So, but you'll get to know her a little bit today, a little bit about what she is working on and where she's focused on today. But just as a reminder to anybody who might be listening, you know, this show is all about winning in Sacramento, building the backyard advantage, the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. And in Sacramento, we have the potential to come together, I think, more than other larger metropolitan areas because of the kind of people we are. And that's what the Backyard Advantage is all about, is really around this culture of love. And let's show some love to one another. And today you get access to someone like Christina Mendonza and her story, which you might not normally get, but you can get it in Sacramento. So welcome to the show, Christina.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here again with you.
Well, it's an honor for me because, I mean, you're a celebrity. Today is not just talking about business and you own your own business, but you're also a media personality. And so everybody in the region, for the most part, knows you and respects you because of the way you, the kind of journalist that you are, the way that you tell your stories is different. And so today I think we'll get educated a little bit on how to tell a compelling story, but also when you tell a story, it comes across with more conviction, I think, than most of us. And you're way of telling the story, we ended up taking it seriously because of your style. So we appreciate
that. Thank you.
It'd be cool if we all knew how to do that.
I think, you know, anyone has the capacity to tell a great story. I know my husband teaches sixth grade. He tells fabulous stories all day long. I love his stories. But I think it's really about the passion for the story. I mean, I love to do research. And what excites me about my business is I love sharing information. If I have information I think I can share with someone that can offer perspective, that can help them make the decisions in their life, that can teach them something new, that's what charges me. So that's why I love, you know, heavily researching my stories. I like working on long form stories. And then of course on the radio station, we're covering stories all day long.
Yeah. So I want to make sure I cover your business and the business of being on the radio. Obviously you've been a media personality for many, many years and you have a great understanding of how that industry has changed. So maybe we'll kind of talk about both, but maybe we'll start with maybe just a little bit of your overview of your background, how you got into media, and then what led to the launch of Mendonza Media.
Yeah.
And what you're focused on today on your business.
Okay. So I grew up in this area, born in Oakland, grew up in Sacramento area, and always wanted to be a journalist. Like since high school, I knew I wanted to be a journalist. Started out first in radio, made the move to television fairly early. I was 20 years old when I made the move to TV. Wow. Worked in several markets inside, outside of California. Right before coming back to California, I was in Denver for quite a few years, met my husband there. Came back here, worked for 20 years for the ABC affiliate here, had a contract non-renewal, as it happens, and decided, you know, I want to do something different. And I looked around and thought, I think I want to start a business. And it was actually at that time, you were the first person to reach out to me, Mark. I will never forget it. You called me up and said, I want to know what you're doing now. Why don't you come out and enjoy and have fun at this entrepreneur event, kind of check it out. I did. I met some great people who inspired me, started my business a couple of months later. It's been going strong for 7 years.
Wow. Well, congratulations on your success. We were talking about the kinds of things that you are doing in terms of helping people, others, to share their story. You're obviously experienced and an expert in that. And the one that leaped out at me, because you've helped me with telling our story for veterans, but a couple of the things that you're working on now are really interesting. You talked about working on a piece for veterans. Is it a documentary?
Yes. Okay. I'm working on a documentary right now. So my business, Mendonza Media, is all about storytelling. So I do that in several ways. I offer media training, which helps people tell their own story. I do video production, which I do the research, I get the video, collect the interviews, all of that, and I tell the story. And then I do crisis communication training, which helps people tell the right story. Mm, yes. So those are the ways I help people with their stories. storytelling. But right now I'm working on a documentary. It's called Sacred Texts of War. And it's about soldiers and airmen and Marines that come home with something called moral injury. Mm. Moral injury is, not a lot of people have heard about it. You've heard of PTSD.
Right.
Moral injury is an adjacent affliction. And it comes, it's the trauma, but it's also the underlining factor in it is guilt, shame, and self-blame. Mm-hmm. So people who feel like they've violated their moral compass, their values. They haven't been, by killing someone, by making a decision that got someone killed, by losing a patient if they were, you know, a corpsman, and they come home with tremendous guilt, shame, and self-blame, and it causes suicide in tremendous numbers. It causes alcoholism. It ruins families. It ruins lives. So I found this clinician, Dr. Melinda Keenan. She's with the Center for Post-Traumatic Growth. She started treating veterans at the VA many years ago. She started to recognize moral injury is something different than PTS because the PTS treatments don't work for moral injury. And she developed a treatment for moral injury and has helped thousands of veterans. So we are talking for an hour to these various veterans. We're getting their stories. We're understanding how they went through this treatment. The treatment is fascinating. It is narrative therapy. So what they do is they write a letter to the person they killed, to the person they lost. Wow.
Write a letter to the person you killed.
So what?
Because you're an enemy, especially if it's an enemy combatant.
Right.
Right. Like Marcus, I'll tell you. He was shot in Afghanistan by the Taliban, and I don't know what he would write to somebody on the other side of that firefight that got killed.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question.
It is. It's an amazing thing. I mean, the way Dr. Keenan explains it, moral injury is caused by a severed relationship between two people. And it doesn't have to be a good relationship or bad relationship. It's a relationship. And because that person's dead, they're gone. There's no way to connect with that person again. But writing a letter transcends time and space and dimension. Mm. You're putting your feelings about the situation and this person out into the universe. So that those letters, once written, are read in a therapy group of other veterans who have suffered moral injury.
And they're probably relatable in a lot of cases. So you get that letter read in a support group, you can connect with it and you don't feel so alone.
Yes. And the veterans there who have gone through the same types of things. And we're talking veterans from Vietnam all the way up to Afghanistan. They're all together. It's very similar. The affliction of moral injury, it's very similar across wars and battles. And they help each other. And through that, the most amazing things happen to these veterans once they've written the letters, they've had them read out loud in therapy, and they discuss it with the other veterans. They have dreams, experiences, things that are unexplainable to them, that happen to them. And it doesn't take away the pain, but it helps them carry it so much more easily. Hmm. So it's really a remarkable therapy. And I'm so excited to present the hour because it's not only these amazing stories of these heroes, but it's also brain science. Because there's actual brain science that show the different parts of the brain that are impacted by PTSD versus moral injury.
Yeah.
With moral injury, there's a whole section of your brain called the precuneus. And that area of the brain is responsible for your moral compass. It's how you see yourself in the world. And that's not impacted by post-traumatic, but it is impacted by moral injury. That area of the brain becomes much more active. And the thought is you need to quiet that area of the brain down.
Interesting, because after Marcus was shot, he was in San Diego, just getting out of the hospital, and I was driving a van that he was in the back of because they loaned us some wheelchair van to drive around in. And I remember we got a call from the family of somebody who was wounded in his little group, in his squad, ended up getting blown up by an IED. And Marcus was in the back, and he had been wounded too. He's in a wheelchair. But he felt that guilt, right? You talked about survivor's guilt. Now, his friend did not die, but he was blown up very badly. But he wanted to be back. And he felt bad because he was the first of his friends to, you know, get knocked out. And I think, and but I knew he felt guilty. And I didn't think about there being a term for that. I had heard of survivor's guilt, but
Moral injury. That's exactly that blame, shame, and guilt. That is exactly what moral injury is, which is why the letters are not written about the trauma. Mm-hmm. They're written to
the
person that caused that moral injury.
Wow. When does that, how far along are you on this project? And when would we see it?
Working like a dog on it every day.
Is that something that comes out a year from now?
We've been working on it. We finally got the funding. So we started shooting. So we're expecting it out in the spring.
Okay, that's great.
So we're working on it right now.
By Memorial Day, who knows?
Yes, that's the hope.
Which is late May. Right. So, okay. So that's one project that you're working on, but you mentioned that you have like these three other, areas of focus within the business. So you help people to share their story, like you helped us with Allegiant share our story of veterans. Maybe just give us a little bit on that, and then we can go to the other aspects, because the crisis management thing, that's got a lot of meat on the bone. That sounds really interesting to me.
And that actually is a lot of fun and very interesting. And I work with fabulous clients on that. But the video production stuff, like the documentary, like what we did with Allegiant, mm-hmm. is helping people tell their stories. That's the video production component. I collect the interviews, the video, I do the research, and I really try to get to the meat of what is this particular business or agency or company doing to put good in the world. And that is what I want to show people. What is the good in the world of putting? So, and that works for a business too, because the good in the world for a business is how they're helping their clients, how they're servicing their clients.
Well, I have my own approach to telling a story. And if I do it the way that I think I should, I think of the format is connect and then tell the story of a journey from why to how, and then ultimately a call to action. That's sort of my...
It's that hero's journey.
That's sort of, that's my approach to some way. I learned it, I don't know, 20 years ago or something, and I've sort of stayed with it. Is there a certain format that you use as kind of cookie cutter, or is everyone different?
You know, I really like, I don't really have a format per se, but when I approach a story, I want to know first, who is the audience? Who are we talking to? And I want to craft the story for them. And then I always tell whatever business I'm working with, the business is not the hero of the story. The customer is the hero of the story. The business is the fairy godmother, is the guide, is the person that helps the customer transform. Mm-hmm. So that is what I look for when I'm talking about doing a story for a business. Businesses, most owners of businesses are actually pretty humble. They don't want to be the hero of their story, but they want to show the good they're doing in the world. And we do that by showing how they are the guide. They're the fairy godmother. Mm-hmm. They have the answers that help the hero, the customer, achieve what they need to achieve.
And doesn't the hero's journey, doesn't the hero always run into this dilemma or this fork in the road, this big challenge, and it's, you create that suspenseful moment? Is that part of it?
Right, and that's where the business sweeps in and says, let me help you out.
Oh, interesting, okay. Yeah, well, that's great. So yeah, most of us are horrible at that, but if you have the right person helping you, you can do it as well. But you, one of the things in your, I talked about this a little bit at the beginning, your speaking style is, it's the kind of speaking style that we take seriously. It probably has something to do with the tone of your voice and the way that you project, but it's also, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's powerful. And many people just aren't, they don't have that. So if you're telling a story and you don't have that, are there any like tips that you might give us so that we can bring it so that people take us more seriously?
So credibility in your voice, it's like learning an instrument almost. I mean, your voice is an instrument. I remember when I very first started in radio, I was like 17 years old, and we had this production guy, and he had these pipes. I mean, he had a great voice, and I used to sit there and watch him and say, how do I get that voice? How do I imbue my voice with credibility and gravitas? And he said, just start reading out loud. Everything you can, everything, all the time, read out loud. Learn how to use your voice like an instrument. So that's what I tell young people. Now, it's difficult to do a voiceover of something. And I've had certain clients that wanted to do their own voiceovers, and which is fine, which is great. And they have a very casual way of speaking, which is much like, you know, on YouTube we see today. People are used to seeing people who aren't like professional broadcasters. But if you want to develop your voice, you have to use it. So you need to be reading out loud a lot.
Yeah, I think you did a voiceover on our one of the videos that you made for us. I think you were, we said, can you do the voiceover for us? I'm like, sure, I'll do it. Yeah. Do you typically do the voiceover in these productions that you make, or do you bring in professionals to do that? How does that work?
Well, it depends on if they want, if like a male or female voice. Mm-hmm. If they want a female voice, I usually do it unless, you know, they have a request for someone else. If they want a male voice, I've got a bunch of colleagues in the business who are ready to step forward and offer a male voice. If they wanted to do it themselves, I'll coach them through it. You know, we'll sit and do take after take until we get the sound that we want. So I can do that as well. I think it's, you know, when you're looking at telling your story, you want someone who has a voice that's fairly comfortable so people want to listen, maybe even want to lean in a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I love doing voiceover work. I'm doing more and more of it now for, you know, I have friends across the country that do video production, or they have, you know, even like a news station back east that needs a voice or whatever. So I enjoy that. That's fun.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's, I don't know if this is the second part of your business that you mentioned, but so if I skip one of the three pieces, we'll circle back around. But crisis management. Okay. You know, let's say somebody gets a high profile person gets a DUI and it's going to come out, or I don't know, maybe we talked about PG&E and the fires and, you know, how are, you know, oh no, did we cause them? And you know, how do you face the media in those kind of situations? Maybe give us some examples of that. And maybe if there's some ways that we should go about thinking about that on our own, because we all of us face crisis almost on a daily basis, and we have to go confront it and get out in front of it. It might be with your wife, it might be with the coworker, it might be with the media, but we got to get out in front of these tough situations and communicate as leaders.
You know, I think the most important thing to do to prepare for a crisis is actually think about it before one happens. So, you know, in graduate school, I got really interested in crisis communication, and I developed a crisis scorecard for agencies. So this, I use this with clients. It kind of gives them here, point one, point two, point three. It's a checklist of things to do, constituencies to think about. Who needs to know what first? What is the message that needs to be crafted now? Do we need a holding message until we get the final message crafted? Who doesn't need to know everything right now? When should we contact the media? Should we wait for them to contact us? So it's a whole scorecard that kind of helps agencies look at what they can do.
Maybe I'll just dive into that one thing you said is when to contact the media. How bad what's the if-then situation on contacting the media? Because if it's a crisis, sometimes we want to get out there so that more lives don't get damaged potentially. Right. But also sometimes these are embarrassing type things, mm-hmm. or they are things that maybe aren't going to make me look good.
Right. If it's internal and there's no danger to the public, usually you want to be able to have your message in place before you contact the media. If it's something where there's obviously a fire, or there's someone on the loose in the community or whatever, then that could be a danger, then you definitely want to contact the media as quickly as possible. I mean, media, contacting the media, that's a tool. It's one of several tools that you have when you're undergoing a crisis.
Do you think that people, there's a tendency for organizations or people to shy away from getting out in front of these stories? I think there's a classic example of Tylenol or something like that, and Johnson & Johnson did not get out in front of it and do a recall, or maybe they did. I don't remember the story exactly, but It really matters when we get out in front of it. If you're late, you look like crap.
Right. And you look like crap if you are deleting things from your Twitter feed without explanation, trying to make things disappear. People see that. They don't like it. So, yeah, I mean, and it all depends, again, on the situation, how you approach it. There's a big trend right now with like Hollywood stars and celebrities that get in trouble and that have an issue to put a written statement on social media. Like, they don't do videos talking about it. They will, like, actually put a statement statement, a written statement out. And that's like
it's exact. Yeah, you're exactly right.
They say exactly. There's no inference in how they're communicating it. There's nothing that people can say, oh, they really meant it this way. It's just a statement that they put out. And that's a big trend right now for people who are in the midst of being canceled.
In terms of trending, is that because that's the wise thing to do?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I haven't worked with a lot of celebrities that have had things happen. Mostly I've worked with agencies on how they contain situations or handle crises within their agencies. And I haven't worked a lot with politicians, so I don't specialize in helping politicians who have an issue with their crisis communications.
There's a local radio guy that just had a DUI, and I'm not going to use his name because I respect the way that he handled the infraction, and he basically took all the blame himself and didn't blame the police or blame anyone else. He threw it all onto himself, very apologetic, but very concise. But also, it was on social media. And when you said that, it was a social media, probably less than 60 words, right? It wasn't overly dramatized. And I came away respecting this guy more. I already respect him as he's a funny, charismatic person, but I came away going, wow, he really took responsibility for this mistake that he had made.
People do like that. They want you to take responsibility and not blame other people. Yeah. That's sense. For sure.
Can you give me an example of somebody that maybe handled it the wrong way? And it's like...
I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I know that in my curriculum, I have certain people that have handled the wrong way. There was a car company. This was, gosh, probably 10 years ago. And I can't remember the brand name of the car company now. They did this commercial where they brought in a bunch of millennials, and they were trying to sell cars to millennials. But they spent like the whole commercial basically insulting them, bringing up every millennial trope and stereotype, and they spent the whole time insulting them, and the commercial did not do well, and it was bad public relations. But then on top of it, they didn't handle it well in the press afterward. I mean, they were kind of arrogant about it, like, you know, whatever.
Interesting. Well, it makes me think a little bit about how politics get involved in business building at times, and there's a couple of examples. More recently to me, I stay away from politics. I listen to you. I listen to certain people around politics, but not super political. But some of these businesses, you see them trying to get out and make a take a stance on a certain issue. And there's some that have backfired recently. Bud Light, you know, I can't drink a Bud Light now without my son giving me a hard time. so I switched to Michelob Ultra, and he's like, it's the same company.
Right.
And then Target has gotten thrown under the bus for their political stance and some things. It's like,
well, it was very fashionable for a while for companies to take a stand on things. Their employees wanted them to take a stand, and it was fashionable for them to do so until it wasn't.
Okay.
And now
fashionable now, kind of suddenly, because of those two are like huge. I think they've lost a lot of business.
I think with a lot of businesses now, they're like, we're making widgets here. Yeah. I can't be handling, you know, all of this political backlash from this employee group or that employee group or that customer group. So I think a lot of companies are shying away from that.
I think sometimes we take, I will lump myself into this as a guy that has employees in his company. We sort of want to keep them happy. And so we take a certain stance based upon what we think is the way the wind might be blowing within our, you know, within our team. And so we come across and make a political statement that sort of represents maybe how the majority of the team thinks, but yet it might not be what's best for the business. And I think I always think of myself, you know, more from the shareholder standpoint of like, why don't we just do what's best for the company? And if you're going to lose a lot of business over it, probably a bad
decision.
That's
kind of my tack too, or my take on it too, is like, you know, I want to do what's best. I would want to see my clients do what's best for their businesses always. I mean, I respect CEOs that come out and have a strong stand on one thing or another, and they're willing to stand behind it, and they're willing to take the backlash if it comes, and that's how they feel. And they're going to be strong personalities in charge of companies that do that. But I mean, when you own a company, especially one that employs a lot of people, that's a lot of responsibility. Do you really want to do something that's going to hurt the paychecks you're writing every 2 weeks? to these people that you care about, that work for you, that are working hard for you.
Right. Okay, so we talked about two parts of your business, right? Helping people tell their stories, crisis management, which I guess is similar, but was specific. Was there one other part?
Media training. I've been doing a ton of media training, and a lot of it has to do with the fact we have an election next year. So politicians want to get tuned up for media training. And then corporate officers want media training because a lot of times they are the head of their companies. They want to tell their own story. So I help them tell their own story in the best way possible, presenting themselves well. So we talk a lot about, you know, camera etiquette, what journalists might be asking them, how to find anecdotes to share within their own company that help, you know, instead of giving talking points, you always want to try to storyfy your talking points into an anecdote, something that makes a great soundbite and helps tell the story well.
Okay, so I'm going to break that answer up into two questions here. Okay, because to me, it's interesting to watch political debates. Sometimes it's boring, and sometimes these guys go off the rails, guys and women. Any advice to somebody who knows they only have a soundbite in time? Because you look at these people on in the Republican debates lately, yeah. And it's like, oh my God, they're fighting with each other instead of debating, right. But yet they're all doing it. So, you know, is that just the nature of the beast? You're supposed to get in there and just beat each other up?
I know. I don't like it either. I mean, I would rather just hear their answers. But a lot of it has to do with just overall campaign strategy. They know someone's leading in the polls, so they want to chop them off at the knees.
Yeah. Is local politics is a lot different than that. Do you work? I'm assuming you're not dealing with presidential candidates.
No.
Right. Okay. No. So I guess it gets a little more cutthroat the higher you get up. But are you dealing with like local politicians and getting their story out?
And statewide.
And state.
And
okay.
Statewide. So it gets pretty cutthroat. Yeah. Yeah. From all parties. Wow. And I've helped them with their media training. Just kind of get tuned up. You know, a lot of us don't, we're not on camera every day. Mm-hmm. So I help them with like the cosmetic aspect of it. You know, what I should be wearing. A lot of people, like you have a great thing here with the Mark Tank, but a lot of people don't even think about what's in the background of them when they are being interviewed.
Okay.
And goodness knows what could be back there that would be embarrassing or, you know, whatever. And they don't think about that. And when they're doing Zooms, you know, how to light themselves, how to, you know, set up a camera shot. And how to judge a camera shot. A lot of times, you know, politicians the reporter will come in, they'll just take it for granted that the shot looks great. And then on TV that night, half their face is dark or, you know, whatever. So, you know, I train assistants how to check your boss's shot and make sure it looks good. How to ask for changes if there's changes that need to be made, how you can, a lot of these cameras, you know, they have a viewfinder that flips around so the candidate themselves can say, may I see the shot? Boom, flip it around, take a look at it, make sure you look all right, make sure you're happy with it, frame you tighter, frame you wider. I know it seems a little bossy, but if you're granting the interview, you want it to look good.
Right.
So we discuss that kind of stuff. And then we also discuss like their talking points. One of the things I tell my clients, and I also, this is something I tell young reporters, I can't stand to see a reporter in the field looking down at their notepad, or it's not even a notepad anymore, it's a phone.
Right.
So they're looking down at their phone, right? So I train young reporters. I want you to hit me with three facts and then toss to your package. And I try to work with politicians and with corporate executives on the same thing. Don't try to memorize 20 talking points. Give me five or three. Yeah.
And using humor, I've got in my Instagram feed some Ronald Reagan humor has started popping up, and I forgot how funny he was because he was tremendous at telling a quick humorous joke, and it made him so likable. Mm-hmm. And I think this is an opinion. I'm drawn to the politicians that are more likable. And I think most people are.
I think everyone,
we want the ones that are likable, not the ones that seem angry and that kind of thing.
It's the whole reason Obama would like sit down and have a beer with someone.
Yeah.
That's such
a likable guy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Interesting.
Exactly.
Okay, so now we're trying to build a personal brand. That's the second half of the training aspect. It's really common for CEOs to want to build a personal brand. They position themselves as the face of the company, but it's not easy to do that necessarily. Are there things, what do we need to work on if we want to build ourselves a personal brand?
Well, I think you have to have a strategy that matches your personality. I mean, you're obviously an extrovert. I mean, you do the show, you are involved in everything. I see you everywhere. But there are some CEOs who are more introverted. They don't really want to have their own podcast, but they still want to be known as being the you know, the leader of their company. So in that way, we have to craft a strategy for them that fits within their life. So maybe that's a certain number of social media posts. Maybe that's sharing their knowledge about something, you know, just once or twice a week, either in video or whatever, get an assistant to help them craft that. So I think the strategy has to match the person, and it has to be authentic to who they are, or no one's going to buy it.
You know, what's interesting is you called me more extroverted. And I think my deep, and this is maybe to other CEOs out there to feel okay about this. I think my normal personality is not as extroverted. I wouldn't call myself an introvert, but when you become the CEO of a company, there is a expectation that you get out in front and communicate the vision, communicate the mission. And if you don't do that, you're not going to be as successful. So as I found myself wanting to be on a great team, sometimes we look around and, I'm the CEO. I guess it's me.
Someone's got to lead.
So if you are a CEO out there, even if you're introverted, you know, it's hard to put the assistant manager, you don't put the vice president out there in front in the big moments. You need to get out there and lead, and so you need to get over it. So as somebody who wants to make a difference, wants to do something important, you're going to want to get out in front.
Right.
And get used to it. And so some of that's just, getting in your reps and you'll get more comfortable.
Exactly. And I fully agree with that because I am an introvert.
Interesting.
I am a natural introvert. I mean, I am all about quiet Friday nights with a couple of friends.
Yeah.
I am like, you know, when I go out and do big events, I'm exhausted afterward. I need to recover. I'm not energized by being around a ton of people. So I'm an introvert. And it's the whole reason I got into journalism was because I thought I need a job where I have an excuse to call someone and say, will you talk to me? I mean, because I'm nervous to talk. I was nervous to talk to people. So the whole reason I became a journalist is because I was a pretty painful introvert.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I wanted to be a journalist for a couple of years. I was the sports editor of my high school newspaper and got a couple of pats on the back for a couple of stories that I wrote. But my English and my grammar and all that, you know, I wasn't that great at all that. And, you know, ran into other stuff, but it does seem like it'd be a cool job. I think it's really,
it's a great job. Yeah. I wish that for the people in the industry that were starting, I wish it was paid more. I do a lot of mentoring for a company called Talent Boulevard. Great company. They're like a LinkedIn for broadcast talent. So I mentor about, at any one time, 3 or 4 young journalists who are making their way through the business. It's a tough business. I mean, it was tough when I was in it too, and when I first got started, but I think it's even tougher now because advertising is down for linear TV, right? So companies aren't making as much, so they're not offering what I think are good salaries, especially when you are in the, you know, bottom 50 or so market. So it's, if you really want to be a journalist, you really have to love it.
Yeah. Okay. So interesting. So what would you tell somebody that wants to be a journalist? Maybe they're in high school now and it seems glamorous to see, you know, to turn on the TV and see, you know, the weather person up there doing that. It looks cool. It looks fun. They're really well known. So you get famous, but you don't get paid a lot of money. So what would you tell them in terms of how to approach that?
Well, what I tell them is if you want to be in this business, you really have to love it. And you will have some amazing experiences, but unless you're able to achieve a certain market size, it's going to be a tough living. So learn everything you can, enjoy the experiences that you have, work as hard as you can to get to the market size you want to be in. And if you're good with it, stay there. But if you're not, use those skills to be a journalist in a different way. I mean, I don't feel like even though I don't work for a TV station anymore, I work for a radio station and I do journalism for a radio station. But in that in-between time when I wasn't working in radio or TV, I still considered myself a journalist. Mm-hmm. I took those skills and I just used them in a different way. I told stories in a different way, which I'm still doing with my company. So I will forever have the heart of a journalist. And those skills, though, aren't just for being on TV or being on radio. Mm-hmm. They are applicable in so many different ways.
Well, a couple of shows ago, you know, I think of the show's coming out right now because we recorded it a couple of weeks ago. We had a guy on who does play-by-play for the Republic. He was actually a professional soccer player. Now he does some stuff on Fox 40. And he's become known through that, which is beneficial. He's also a commercial realtor. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting to think about how to use your notoriety and your, you know, the fact that people respect you for what you do on Fox 40 or what you might do on the athletic field,
yeah,
and utilize that to build a different kind of business. And so there may be a way to sort of parlay some of those assets. I'm sure at some level that's part of what has helped you over the years, right?
Absolutely.
You're a media personality that is also building a successful business.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think we have to think more that way because hardly anyone gets into a business and spends 30 years in that business anymore. I mean, I think in that respect, I'm kind of a dinosaur. You know, I started very young. I was in television and radio at 17, in television by 20, and there until my late 40s. And that's not really common anymore. I think people change careers much more these days. So you have to be able to pick up that set of skills and move somewhere else and use mm-hmm. them in another industry. And there's more than one thing most of us are interested in. You know, I mean, I loved anchoring newscasts, but when I was done doing it and I moved on, I mean, I kind of felt like, okay, I've been there, I've done that. What else can I do? What else can I do? So I'm like, and I think you're the same way, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs are, I'm a forward-thinking person. You know, they say people who look backwards and think about the past are depressed. People who are always thinking about the future have anxiety. I'm more a future thinker, so yeah. I would say I more tend to anxiety than depression, but I am always thinking about the future. If it's happened in the past, I don't hold grudges. I don't think I do. I try to move on.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, well, let's think about that for a second. If we think about where the puck is going in media, mm-hmm. When we think you were talking about the wages have not increased, they've probably decreased, you know, respectively. Thinking about the state of the media as we know it today, where when I was a kid and even as a young adult, the media was more trusted. For me, it didn't seem so negative. We weren't so divisive. Mm-hmm. Now we turn on, let's call it turn on TV, and you're going to get less what feels like objective journalism and more opinion and more divisive sort of opinion. And it's like it's gradually degrading from what it might have been. I don't know if you would agree with that 100%, but like, walk me through that that puck journey to from then to now to where it's going.
Well, we used to have, you know, just three or four channels that
yeah.
we would watch for news, right? And so all of them were competing with each other, and they were trying to put the best journalism forward that they could. Then when we went to the 24-hour model and started with cable, then you need to fill something with that 24 hours, right?
Right.
So they were all trying to fill them, and I think that's where things started, because in between actual stuff happening, they had to fill the time. Well, let's get some commentators on, and let's do analysis, and let's talk about, you know, this particular issue in longer form, and you know what? Let's bring someone on with the opposite opinion. Let's have a discussion. Let's have a debate. And then pretty soon it was an argument. Mm-hmm. And now we've just have a proliferation of various channels. Everyone's trying to stake out a little bit of the media landscape. So they're maybe picking one side or the other. And then all of us are usually in our silos, and we have, you know, we're either CNN watchers or Fox News watchers. And then, you know, all the other proliferation of media that branches off from those two things, that we're tuning into that. We're, you know, listening to, you know, whatever, Joe Rogan or, you know, whoever on the liberal side. And so that's what a lot of people are doing right now. So I think you, as a consumer, if you want both sides, you have to get out of your silo.
Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, social media for sure, and, you know, podcasts and those kind of things give, you know, there's so many ways to take in our, you know, get our news. When I texted you this morning, I was driving to yoga, like, I leave about 5:20 in the morning, and listening to you and Sam, that's my normal routine. Yay. Is to listen to you guys my way up to yoga. You two, I love how you play off of each other, and, you know, you take this variety of news that is thrown at us, and you help digest it so that we can, you know, understand it. But you seem so objective, and you add a little bit of humor here and there to what feels like a lot of negative crap. Mm-hmm. And then you add today, you were did something about Joe Manchin, and, you know, he was going on a tour
around the country.
Yeah, yep. And you joked, and not joking facetiously, but it sounded kind of humorous because you left a little pause. You said, and he's running for president too,
right,
or something like
right.
that. Yeah. Yeah. So it was kind of, you know, you add this, you know, this dimension of humor, not putting down Joe, not promoting Joe. You're more just calling it the way that it is.
Right.
And I don't feel that much anymore. On KFBK, I do feel that, to tell you the truth, but I don't feel that on almost any other media that I'm watching listening to.
You know, Sam and I started together the show more than 5 years ago, and I had not... I knew of Sam because he worked at Channel 13. I was at Channel 10. So I'd known of him. I don't think we ever even met until we were together in the studio suddenly. And we did like a practice run through, I remember, the weekend before he started on the show. And we were laughing afterward because both of us coming from television, we have very similar backgrounds in television. We kind of spoke the same language. And then we sat down and we wanted to design a different show. And both of us said, we want this show to feel like two journalists talking about the news, not presenting headlines, but talking about the news like co-anchors would during the break.
Ah, interesting.
And so that's the way we designed the show. That's the way it's supposed to feel. It's supposed to feel like we're anchors in a break talking about the news. And we wanted it that way because we understand, after all of these years on television, when we read a story, the viewer's taking in the story, but they're also saying all those things that we say to themselves. As we're mm-hmm. like, you know, if I were to say, you know, Joe Manchin said he's not going to run for Senate again. He's decided to take a trip across the country and then just take the temperature of the American people. You would watch that in your head. You'd say, because he's running for president. So we say the things
right.
that we feel like our listeners are thinking.
Yeah, that's interesting. I love that. And it's cool that you do that. And you rarely, you will have an opinion on something, especially if it's something that's really hypocritical, it'll get mentioned or something like that. But you don't take a left, what most people would take as a left or a right wing stance on things. At least I don't pick up on that. I just hear you calling it how it is. But I've often wondered about, so when COVID hit, somewhere around there, I quit watching. I would be the guy that watched Fox News at the end of the night or watch the news here and there. Mm-hmm. And I just did. I quit turning on the news. I might have watched some Netflix and stuff, but I quit watching the news when COVID hit, which was like three years ago or more. And because it was so negative, mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't need any more negative. I mean, my wife's all worried about COVID. The whole world's yes. coming apart. Oh, yes. No. World's coming to an end. And got me even I found it really affecting my mood that I was consuming so much negativity. I turned it off. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I was thinking about, you know, you coming on the show today and the amount of negativity that you have to sort of sift through, if you will. You get all the data, and now you have to help share that story. But a lot of it's negative.
Yes.
Because parts of life are negative. And in reality, most of the media is sensationalizing the negative because that's how you get the ratings, I suppose. And that's what's interesting to people. But it's a lot of negative that you have to deal with every morning, mm-hmm. and or maybe every day. And like, gosh, does that ever affect you?
Absolutely, it does. And you know what? When I was younger, like when I first started in the business, nothing affected me. I could go out to like homicide stories. I mean, I was on crime in court for a while, covered some brutal stuff. It didn't affect me. As I got older, and the older I get, the more it does. But I have self-saving mechanisms in place. So like when I get up in the morning at 3 a.m. in the morning, I do not look at news, listen to news for the first 15, 20 minutes. I have a whole affirmation series that I listen to. I start my day off I don't drink coffee. I drink water. I do a little meditation. From that first half hour.
You get a clear head of what life's all about.
Get a clear head. And then I'll head into the station. And on the way to the station is when I start consuming all the headlines from overnight.
And how do you consume that?
Usually podcasts. I have about 4 or 5 podcasts that I listen to on the way to work, or I listen to portions of them, skip through them. And then I have already the day before, the night before, before I went to bed, I will have sent myself things that I saw.
Okay.
And then also the day before, I will have already produced a couple of segments. And Sam does the same thing at home.
So podcasts, I have a podcast, but I'm not this big podcast from... The people that I follow on podcasts, it's not breaking news. What you guys are sharing is the latest news. You're sharing way up-to-date stuff that just got announced yesterday. So what podcasts would those be that have the breaking news?
So I'll listen to all the network podcasts.
Okay.
And I'll listen to the Wall Street Journal in the morning and the New York Times podcast and all of those. So I'll get those to get kind of what happened overnight because they're on East Coast time, obviously. So they've already filed those reports. But a lot of the show, when we get in, we have a basic idea of like clips of the hour we're going to play that we've pulled, stories that happened overnight. But a lot of the stuff that we put in the show is stuff that is happening in real time. We call it flying the plane building the plane as we fly it. I mean, that's exactly how the show is.
Okay, so you're at the show in studio, down at iHeart, deciding what you're going to talk about in the next segment.
Right. Sometimes I'll be cutting sound.
Okay.
When a commercial's on, or Sam will be feeding something in, or our executive producer is working on something, or our tech producer is working on something. We've got several screens going. So I've got windows for different things. I've highlighted certain sections of things I want us to talk about, news that's happening locally. I have my Twitter feed going. So we are constantly trying to confirm stuff, trying to cut stuff throughout the entire show. So when the show's over, I just want to go stare at a wall for like 30 minutes. I'm exhausted. But in terms of the negativity, I think there is a point at which I'm like, okay, I got to turn it off today. I got to just go take a run, go spend some time with my husband.
Yeah, you can only have so much of it.
Yeah. You can only take in so much.
So, okay, very interesting. Okay, so maybe one or two more questions.
I'll
let you get out of here. I appreciate you coming, making the time for me. So I used to have the show on Talk 650, so I'd go into iHeart, and I was not a main star. I was, I was the trash of the thing. So I ended up doing my own studio here, and ultimately we got off the radio, and we're just a podcast now, but... Thinking about when I walk into iHeart, I mean, it's kind of inspirational. I remember I went from the other studio prior, which was great. It was the only thing I knew. And then I walked into iHeart and it's like, wow, bright and pop. And what's it like at 5 o'clock in the morning? Is it just you and Sam and maybe like one other person? Or is it popping and happening? What's the prime time feel?
Well, we're the first there. It's early. Like basically our executive producer and our tech producer are the first people there. And then Sam and I come in. So it's very quiet. And then there's a reporter that comes in that is working as well. So things are pretty quiet. And then, next door to us is Armstrong and Getty.
Oh yeah.
And so we'll see those guys.
They're laughing
and they're producers.
Yeah. Yep.
And then down the hall is Dog and Joe.
Okay.
And
yes.
So, you know, we'll see Joe in his robe, like warm, wandering the halls.
Yeah. And those guys are all like, you guys are all like celebrities though. So people are, you know, it's local celebrities at least.
Yeah. I'll see, you know, I'll see Jack Armstrong as we're both making a dash for the bathroom in the break.
Ah, that's hilarious.
So, I mean, it's, yeah, it's a lively place.
Is it like fun? Because, I mean, when you described some of those other people, I forgot about them being there because I was borrowing Armstrong and Getty's show, or excuse me, their studio, which was a disaster. They don't like pick up after themselves. And so they got mad at me for like moving something off to the side. And I'm like, okay, I'm getting my own studio. I'm not going to live in this place.
I don't see them that very often. Like I said, it's like,
hope they're not listening.
It's like when I dash to the restroom, I might see one of them and we'll wave to each other in the hall or say hello. They're so busy. I mean, when we come in, it's like you hit the ground at, you know, 4 a.m. and it's just, it's all out until 9:30.
Oh my gosh. Well, it sounds like, I mean, I think it's something that a lot of us would, you know, we look up to you, but we also imagine what it might like to be in an occupation like that. So it's good to get a little bit of the feel for what it is behind the screen.
I always tell people I will never not hate that 3 a.m. alarm. Oh. I mean, that every day when it goes off at 3 a.m., I'm like, oh. But by the time I get to work and I'm sitting in that chair, we're having fun.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. Well, I guess it's a lot about who you work with too, huh?
Yeah, it is. And you know, like I said, Sam and I had never even met each other. So the fact that we feel such chemistry with each other on this show, I mean, we really do. I mean, it's amazing how we finish each other's sentences and we've just kind of fallen into that co-anchor space. And he's among the best co-anchors I've ever had.
I didn't know much about him. I think I might have spoke on a panel or within the same room as him one time. So I'd heard him speak once and, oh, good guy. And then you two started the show together and I was listening to it probably because of you. And I like that guy. He's good.
I love about Sam? I tell people he has this work ethic.
Oh.
He's just got this incredible work ethic. He cares incredibly about the show and about the content that we produce. So he cares incredibly about that. And he's funny. And he loves politics. And so all those things make for a good workmate.
That's awesome. Okay, so last question. What did I not ask you that we need to get out? What would our audience appreciate? And what is there anything you want to get out?
I appreciate the opportunity to talk about all the different things that that I'm doing at Mendonza Media and about the radio show. And I want to say I just live in like gratitude every day. I really do. I'm so grateful that I've been able to do what I love to do in a place I love to do it for this long. And so thank you. Thank you if you watch the radio show. Thank you if you consume any of the content. Hopefully you'll watch the documentary when it's produced. I'm working with a producer out of New York who does a lot of work for Amazon and Netflix. So who knows?
All right.
We'll see where it ends up. But I just am grateful.
That's
yeah.
awesome. Well, I'm grateful you came on the show and for all the help you've given me over the years. So thank you.
Likewise. Christina. Thank you very much.
You betcha.